Hello, and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage, episode number 22, brought to you by Chaos Group. For you architects out there, last week was AIA 2015 in Atlanta, and Chaos Group was there, and we presented something pretty cool. We presented V-Ray inside of Revit, and it got a lot of really good attention. So follow up on that and see what's going on, because if you guys are ever interested in V-Ray running inside of Revit, that is a really cool thing to see. That said, we have a lot of other cool things coming up. Sorry I wasn't able to put out a podcast last week. I just got back from FMX and it was just kind of crazy and I was jet lagged and everything else. But this episode is really cool. We have Alan McKay, and you may have noticed, if you do follow the Alan McKay podcast, you will notice that I was on that podcast and sort of was a quid pro quo. I was on his podcast and he came onto mine and we talked about what was going on. Alan is an extremely interesting guy. He has been doing this for a very long time and he's still a young guy. He's actually been doing CG professionally since he was 13, and he has been doing an enormous amount of work in that area and has focused this last year in education, and we talk about what his mentorship program is about, which is really, really great. We also talk about the idea of podcasts in general, which is actually kind of interesting. Whenever you bring two guys who do podcasts and they talk about stuff together, it always ends up being very relaxed because we already know what it's all about and how it's going to work. I really, really enjoyed this podcast, and you will quickly notice that Alan and I get along really well, and I think that probably Alan and I will continue to do things for the community in the near future, because I think we could really do some great work together. Anyway, hope that you guys enjoyed as much as I did. All right, thanks a lot, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
How long have you been doing this?
Oh, God. 20 years?
20 years. And so, how old are you?
Next Friday. Actually, I just mentioned next Friday doing the industry drink, so I'm actually turning 33 next Friday as well.
33. So you've been doing this since you were 13.
Yep. I quit school when I was 13, and I started making web pages and basically got into video games. I worked from home for about 2 years, 3 years doing video games.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So that was, you already knew at the age of 13 what you wanted to do.
It was one of those, I stopped school, and then after a while, I'm like, okay, well, I grew up with a lot of deadbeat people who kind of, the people in like a small town that I came from, like who didn't finish school and ended up like doing kind of crazy jobs. And I'm in my head, I was kind of like, okay, I got to, kind of get out of that rut. So I decided, okay, I got to pick a career and make something of it, which sounds so weird. Being
13,
yeah, I've had a weird life just because I love my mom to death, but like basically we kind of raised each other, and I was paying rent when I was 14, and kind of like by that time in my life, I'd kind of become the adult, and I was kind of living out my own life. I moved out when I was 16 to the other side of the country and started working in games and then film, and yeah, it's been an odd time.
Wow.
Actually, I was lecturing at university at 17.
You were a lecturer at 17.
And I built two of the curriculums for two of the biggest universities. The Bachelor of Interactive Entertainment, which was the first video game bachelor in Australia at the time.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I don't know. I always look at my career and I'm like, yeah, it's not normal, but.
No, well, no, it's not. But, I mean, obviously it's been working for you, so.
3D was young back then as well. I mean, we're still back on the SGIs, like the Octanes had come out.
Right.
And 3D Studio for DOS, Maya came out like 96, 97. So,
how old were you when you were like, let's say like 16 and you're sort of really getting involved in this stuff? What year was that about?
I think it was 97.
97. Okay.
Yeah. So like Independence Day just came out. Like I had a meeting with Volker Engel, who did Independence Day and Godzilla and everything, I had a meeting with him a few weeks back. And for me, it was kind of like, you know, one of those, like, you're sitting there and reminiscing about, like, watching all the making of and all the other stuff, like,
yep,
before DVDs were even out. And you're like, oh my God, like, you know, I remember being 16 and going to see Independence Day at the theaters.
Yep.
And I'd rush home at night and I'd be recreating everything I could in, like, 3D Studio DOS using, like, iPass routines from Yoast Group or whatever,
yeah,
like,
yep,
trying to do what they're doing. And it's just kind of, it's one of those moments where you actually get to reflect and be like, whoa, okay, like, now here I am, like, sitting other side of the world, like, talking about, like, you know, future projects. And I was like, this is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So it's great.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting how that got involved. And so you were passionate from the start. I mean, that passion was very, very strong.
Yeah, I will
say. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Australia, like Brisbane, Australia, which is just up north from Sydney.
Right.
And I will touch on that for a second to say that, like, I strongly do believe if you want to be good at anything, and I'm not trying to say, like, I'm good or bad, but it's just more like, if you really want to succeed at something, you really need to be obsessed about it. You know, you need to.
Committed.
Yeah. And it's more like you need to surround yourself with it. And you need to make it your life. And that isn't just VFX or whatever. It's everything. And if you want to pick up, like, you know, a musical instrument or whatever you want to do, you need to obsess about it. You need to just make it your world for a while and, like, just saturate your life with it to get that good. Or otherwise, it's going to be something you pick up for a bit and then, meh, it's okay, and, like, move on to the right. Next, you know?
Yeah, a lot of kids have taken piano when they were kids, but very few of them are master piano players, right?
That's right.
In order to be a master piano player, you have to really dig involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's an excellent analogy about just really getting engaged in it. And the fact that you did it at that age is kind of surprising that you were able to do that, because that's really kind of cool.
It was daunting because back then you didn't have the internet. That was, like, one thing. It's just, you know, you couldn't go on YouTube and be like, oh, how do you do this? And, like, I'm building this tool to, like, automate, you know, we're talking about it earlier, like, basically build this, like, really automated process. And, you know, instantly whenever there's, like, a scripting command you can't figure out, you jump on Google and it comes up with, like, 1,000 things. You click on something, copy and paste, move on. And back then I had a book from New Writers Publishing, Inside 3D Studio R3 for DOS. Mm-hmm. And that's the only bit of education I ever got. Was I bought a book for like $80 and had like 5 color pages. And coincidentally, one of the printed images in that book ended up being, like, an artist who did that, ended up being someone who got me my kind of big break later on in my career and, like, small world. But yeah, you know, buying a book and then kind of being like, all right, like, it's up to me to figure out, like, what the hell is keyframing? Because I didn't have a manual. So it's like, okay, you know, what is so self-explanatory at the time is just like, I don't get this, like, this object's not doing what I want, you know, it's a whole other world. And, like, now I love the fact that schools are actually teaching the stuff. Like, even in high school, you can get a chance to, you know, dive in and learn some 3D and, you know. Great.
Back, I remember, you know, thinking about circa 1995 or so when Maya came out or whenever, and you would buy this program and it would cost a fortune, you know.
Yeah, $8,000.
I think when Maya first came out, it was more than $8,000. I think it was like $30,000 or $50,000. The first version.
I know
Maya.
Softimage was like $15,000. I forget what Maya was.
I think Maya it was insanely expensive.
But the SGIs were too, so everything's priced.
Everything was high, right? And then you would buy it and there was no online referencing or no online tutorial. So you would buy it and it would come with
the manuals.
And I'm stretching my arms out as far as I can go in this example. I'm literally talking about, you know, a meter and a half worth of manuals that would come with this stuff, that everything you would possibly could know about whatever this program had to do. And it was just overwhelming. It was like, well, that's what $30,000 bought me or whatever it was.
I honestly think that that's part of it, is to justify, because otherwise, like, you got a CD-ROM, or actually even back then it was like 15 floppy disks.
Right.
And but, like, no, I had the Softimage 3.7 Extreme manuals, right? And, like, you take them all out and you would keep the boxes because it made your bookshelf, you know, it was like kind of like your table. And, like, I kind of feel like the manuals was would kind of help you feel more happy with, like, I purchased.
Yeah, it was a justification of, like, how much you would buy. Yeah.
It's so pricey. And, like, yeah. And then, like, I remember when they switched to doing all online documentation.
Right. You know, and then you would get there and all they had was an installation instruction.
And that was like, it. No, like, you know, it's all in the packaging. Haven't you heard Apple? Like, it's all in the pretty packaging, damn it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so that was kind of interesting. So that's basically how you started and got involved. What was your big break? You mentioned that.
I mentioned that because, like, I bought that book, and then, like, years later, like, the first big project I ever worked on was Half-Life for Valve Software.
Oh, right.
And it was kind of funny, like, and I was talking about this recently. I was in Paris doing a talk, and I mentioned this just because I guess I wanted to make it really paint a picture of, like, you know, getting your foot in the door is hard. Once you get your foot in the door, like, really get your foot in the door, it's smooth sailing. But I basically slaved away 24 hours a day. The only time I would sleep is when I hit render, and I would see the estimate of, like, 6 hours till render complete.
And that's, you know, you had six hours.
I would set my alarm. Yeah, and I would go to sleep at 6 a.m. I would get up at 10 or 11 a.m. and I would do it every day. I was just, you know, for me, it was like, I had to do this. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately, about how early on, like, I was ready to give up so many times, and, like, I would literally have to, like, talk myself and, like, just one more reel, you know. And I probably built, like, six reels trying to get in there. And, like, 3D back then, especially in Australia, was not a popular thing. It was, you know, there's only a few studios. Like, when The Matrix came out in 99, that was when we first, like, because that was all shot in Australia. Like, that was, like, a big break for Australia. But before that, there wasn't really that much going on. And if I told people, like, oh, I do 3D, they're like, what's that? You know, and
right.
So for me at the time, like, it was definitely, I was on it alone, and I didn't know anyone, and I didn't have internet or anything to kind of reach out. And, you know, eventually I did. And all the guys who I knew back then are, like, you know, Marcos, who wrote Arnold, you know,
right,
like,
yeah.
A lot of the VFX soups at ILM, like, all the guys that I knew are all, like, you know, we still know each other, and we've all kind of grown up together, and it's been so cool. But at the time, I bought a book, and that was all I had. And then I got a job. I finally decided, okay, I've got enough work. I'm going to look for my first job. And I emailed two companies. One was Ritual, who were in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
They did Sin and a few other video games, like, back in the day. And the other one was Team Fortress Software, which coincidentally just got bought by Valve, and they're about to make release Half-Life. And so I ended up working on Team Fortress 2, which had, like, an interesting production cycle. It basically was part of Half-Life 1 and then became a standalone game, and then went through this big development cycle, went for 10 years, and finally came out in 2006. And
right.
I found out about that because I had a meeting with Sega, and I was in there and I saw one of their artists at this Team Fortress 2 wallpaper, you know, 10 years later. And I'm like, hold on, I gotta go talk about this for a sec. What is that? And they're like, oh, TF2 just, you know, got announced. I'm like, no, it's been announced a lot more times before that. But coincidentally, one of the artists who was working on that project, he was one of the artists who had, you know, those six pages that were color. Like, he had this mech that he built, like, his really sketchy thing, you know, back then. But
sure.
Yeah, so we kind of bonded. It was, you know, we're both from Australia working on this game together. And he freelanced for this company called Ambience, which was in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, there was, like, Animal Logic and Ambience, the two big studios, and GMD, which is his other place. And yeah, like, coincidentally, he put me in contact with, like, the head of 3D, who they offered me a job. I didn't bite the bullet right away because I was kind of a bit skeptical about moving across the country. But, you know, I still to this day think that, like, when I finally did take that job, that was, like, the biggest kind of growth I had, you know, just
sure.
The first time I got exposed to artists who had been doing this for years. And, you know, even my first 2 weeks, I felt like I unlearned everything and learned all this new information, which I still follow to this day, you know, and I think it's so powerful. But what I was going to mention is, with video games, is that I finally had that big break. I worked on Half-Life, which was a AAA game, one of the biggest, you know, in game history.
Sure.
But, you know, at that point you would think, okay, that's where you made your big break. But, like, I then had that plateau where after that project, there was about a year where I'd still be struggling to find work. And I figure it's worthwhile mentioning something like that because you know, it's definitely tricky in the beginning getting that momentum. And I've had those times where I'm, you know, even after that project, I'm like a year of kind of, like, you know, trying to find the next job, and it's not easy. But finally, when you do get the really big break, then it's like, okay, like you don't need to worry about finding work after that, I don't think.
Well, I've had this discussion with some other guys, and it was mainly about the idea that back then, let's think, you know, late 90s, early 2000s or whatever, it was, you had to get that break, right? Mm-hmm. You had to have someone that lets you in. One of my friends, Eric Hansen, he always said, it's like the industry is like there's a giant bouncer at the club.
Mm-hmm.
And then once that bouncer knows who you are, you can go to any club, right?
Yep.
Like, and that was the way it was for a long time. It's like, oh, they wouldn't even talk to you unless you had one thing under your belt. And then mm-hmm. it was fine. So it was a very different time back then. I think now a lot of people there is a lot of people that can go out on because of the internet.
Yep, yep.
You can, if you do good work on the internet and people find you and you can stand out amongst the millions of people that do great work. But if you can really stand out, then that's going to be your key as opposed to just like finding a way into something.
I think now that's one thing I've said so many times is like, anyone who says like it's so difficult to find work or like right now because of all the jobs, or whatever, it's like that is a load of crap. Like right now it is the time to get work. Like if you want a job, you know, I do think it's important to really kind of be smart about your career and like
sure.
really treat it like a business rather than being like, oh, I'm just going to make some good work and I'll get hired. It's like, no, you really need to think ahead and be strategic. But it is so... Now is the time to get work in this industry.
I think it also is there's actually a lot more jobs out there than the mm-hmm. jobs that people think they are, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just films anymore. It's not like I'm going to do the next Transformers or whatever it is. There are TV shows that are being really unbelievably well done. Like, you know, Game of Thrones is like ridiculously high level VFX. Yeah. And then also, you know, commercials are really well done. But then there's also a lot of the VR work that's being done. There is a huge amount of CG demand right now that is not centered around the general industries that people feel they need to be involved with. You know, mm-hmm. I was, as just an example, like some people were like work really, 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 really hard to get on some, you know, Pixar movie or some DreamWorks movie. And,
mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily going to be the most important thing. And that's a huge commitment on your life, but you can really look at some amazing work that's out there. So I think there's a lot of inspiration in terms of what CG is about. And it's not always centered around the next big budget summer movie. And I think that that's a good thing because I think that really sort of opens up the diversity. And I think people need to open up their minds in terms of what's out there that they can actually do.
Absolutely. I think it's like with anything, I think you need to adapt and kind of use, you know, be smart about it. Like I mentioned I was hanging out with a few friends last night who were in the industry and like they're doing things a bit differently and they're doing a lot of scanning, like 3D scanning, face scanning.
Mm-hmm.
And talking with them, it's like, you know, they came from doing 3D, but the stuff they're doing now with all the cameras and capturing stuff, like they do 3D scanning, body scanning. But on top of that, like they go to a lot of events like trade shows and they're doing bullet time, which obviously, you know, was a huge thing back in like 99 with the Matrix.
Sure.
But because they have like 60 cameras at their disposal, like all Nikons, they just set them all up and go to a trade show and people jump up and in the air and do something. And,
right.
You know, they send an email with the video and there's like stuff like that. But then they've got stuff with, you know, weapons and other stuff they're doing. I love with them just the fact that they had kind of built a niche thing that they're doing. But even then they're diversifying to the point where they're doing a lot more. And I was kind of surprised just because I'm like, okay, great. Like you're not just owning this one area. You're still looking at other ways to get that bread and butter. And like,
sure,
you know, taking one concept and expanding into multiple revenue streams, that's great. And like, 3D, you know, TV right now is big, VR is big, apps are big. There's so many different things you can do. Like, why not? Like, I have good friends who make digital comic books and like illustration stuff like
sure.
that, you know, do Kickstarter stuff, 3D printing, like digital jewelry, you know, like there's so much stuff you can do. So
yeah,
it's great.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, content creation is out there and it's not, it's pretty big. So that's a pretty cool thing. And you worked on a lot of big things. So name some of the big projects you might have worked on.
I'm terrible at this because, like, even if I'm having interviews and stuff, like actual job, like meetings, I'll have to look up IMDb.
And okay. All right. I'll tell you this. I'll reverse the question. Name some of the projects you're the least proud of.
Actually,
that's probably easier. Yeah.
Well, actually, two things. So I was talking with some people yesterday and they actually corrected me because I mentioned I'm actually right now blowing one of the projects I'm on. I'm blowing up a planet. And I'm like, yeah, I've never actually done this before. And someone on Facebook the other day is like, well, didn't you blow up Krypton and the sun in Superman Returns? Superman,
yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah. I totally forgot about that.
He forgot that I actually did that. Yeah.
So they were like, oh, by the way, you do 3D in case you forgot. But yeah. I had a podcast interview with RSP, Rising Sun Productions in Australia yesterday. And it's kind of funny because Australia, especially years and like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, one studio gets the work, all the studios get the work. So
sure.
Basically, like I looked at their credentials and I laughed because like, some of the things on there are the same kind of like scars that I have on my resume, like George of the Jungle 2 and Inspector Gadget 2. And like, I actually got reached out to work on The Matrix 2.
Right.
And they wanted to do this like really massive explosion sequence. And they reached out specifically to me to work on that. And the day before that, I had agreed to do Inspector Gadget 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kicking myself just, you know, these days I think I would, you know, agreeing to something is not like the end of the world. But back then I'm like, no, I agree to this. I'm going to see it through. And yes, I ended up turning down the Matrix sequel just to do a George of the Jungle sequel, which, you know, straight to DVD or whatever. You
sure.
Know? Yeah.
We've got a lot of like crappy movies on our belt. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. And that's okay. I mean, there was a friend of mine who said, there's three things that motivate you in terms of what you want to do in terms of making movies. One is the money you're making. If they offer you a whole lot of money, sure. then that's your motivation. The other one is the people you're working with. It's like, oh, those are the guys. I want to work with those guys.
That's usually my incentive.
That's a very good incentive because you're going to be committed for like 9 months or a year or whatever it is. And like, yeah, I want to work with those guys. And then three is the project, right? So there's three incentives. So only 1/3 of the incentive is actually the quality of the project.
That's right.
And if it's a crappy movie, it's a crappy movie. You don't actually care. And yep. I don't care anymore. Well, I don't work in feature films anymore, but like, oh, I want to get a credit on blah, 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 blah. It's like, yeah, I don't care anymore. You know,
yep.
And that's not what's the incentive anymore. It's the incentive is how much fun is it going to be to just do this kind of stuff? So, and you're right, the team is almost like the most important part of it because every day you're going to, the VFX is a team collaborative thing. And if you're not getting along with your team, then it's not worth it, you know?
Yeah. It's kind of funny because like, I think there's an ordering to it as well. Like typically the money part of it, it's usually if you really don't want to do a project and like, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to crank the price on this because like, I know it's going to, you know, I've worked with these people before and it was hell or whatever. And therefore it's kind of like, you want to tax them for it. But like, that's usually where the money comes in. Whereas like I've thought about this a lot too, just because I've gone through a lot of projects where like I will actively be saying no to a lot of jobs and I'll say no to DD and Scanline and a few other places in the same week. And then I'll get a place that literally is doing one of their first projects at their studio and I'll say yes to them. And I've had to stop and think like, whoa, like out of all these jobs, I said yes to them. Like, why is that? And then it's like, well, they took me out for a beer and we had a great time. And then they said, by the way, we're doing this small car commercial. Are you interested? And I'm like, yeah, you guys are cool. And, you know, I've had to think about that and kind of re-engineer it. Like, okay, yeah, it's more, I guess, like, you know, you get to know the people and picture yourself working with them and suddenly it's like a fun experience.
Right.
Rather than it being like, okay, I'm going to go on and work on this big production with all these people. And it's just, you know, that can be fun. But, you know, at the end of the day, like a job is a job and you want to care more about like the people you work with and the experience that you have, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. I think it's very, very critical to do that. And but you've worked on hundreds of projects in the 20 years that you've been doing this. So that's been a pretty good experience for you. What has, how has that carried you through at this point? What, I mean, you're not actually, you've made a decision in the last, was it a year or 2 years to sort of move out of production for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So what motivated you to do that? And what exactly are you doing?
I guess it's a good point. I mean, I started doing like training, like tutorials and stuff. Probably 98 is when I made my first. I think the first ever sub D modeling tutorial. It's still out there, unfortunately, so you can Google it. But
this is in 3D Studio, right?
Yeah, 3ds Max.
Yeah,
and it's just because, like, for me, especially in the 90s, you know, people were very protective about what they did, and so. Typically someone might be really good at making sparks or really good at animating, you know, cartoon characters, but that's their thing. And so if you went up to someone and said like, wow, like you did an amazing job, like how do you do that? They'd be like, I'm not telling you. Like, I'm, you know, why would I tell you
I'll tell you, that's why people hire me. Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of hated that. And for me, like I was more into experimenting. Like I had a lot of the peers, like people I worked with who were always kind of frustrated with me because I would do like, you know, all my own R&D and like do all this cool stuff. But they would kind of be baffled why I didn't make a short film out of it. I do like a 3-second thing and I'm like, okay, I figured that out. Time to move on to the next thing.
Sure.
How do you make clouds? How do you make fire? And it was just one of those things that for me, I was more interested in figuring out how to do it. And because people didn't share information, I wanted to share everything I did. And that way, you know, people wouldn't have to go through the trouble I went through. And so early on, I got really big into that. And like, I've always enjoyed just sharing information and helping anyone I can. And then I started doing a lot of training. I've helped like CG Society since they began doing their workshops. I've been helping them with all their stuff as well as, you know, other places like Nomal and everyone else. And I don't know, like for me, it's kind of become a bit apparent in the last couple of years that doing training is cool, but typically someone picks up a product, they check it out and that's it. And like, the past 2 or 3 years, like especially I've been reviewing a lot of reels. I've had to build up teams and it's gotten to the point like I was at Blur recently and I would have to look through probably over 100 reels and I could pinpoint the tutorials people were doing and, you know, it's like, oh, there's a little bit of a fume in there and, you know, this thing over here. And I kind of felt like everyone's work, they followed the training or did whatever they did, but like no one really knew what it would take to get a shot finaled. And to me, sure. That was the most critical thing was like knowing how to get a shot, pick it up and be able to approach it and, you know, getting the timing right, the waiting, all the things that you need to really analyze your shot and look at it, like, how can I make this better? And that kind of just didn't get applied. So for me, I wanted to build an experience where people are accountable for what they're doing. And I figured anything I've done where it's like a, you know, a few weeks to train someone, it isn't long enough. So I decided this year to actually dedicate like an entire year to just kind of giving back. And I wanted to mentor, a bunch of students and work with them for almost a year and just really kind of push the bar on what they're doing.
So you're taking this on as like, all right, I'm going to train people how to do this beyond just doing tutorials, right?
Literally to the point where the ones who do all the material and they really apply themselves, I will personally go to ILM. I will personally go to Blur. And I will say like, these guys are ready. Cause I get contacted. I'm fortunate in that regard, but I get contacted regularly. I mean, since we sat down, there's been a few things pop up and
right. It's
been great. But I mean, it's because like, you know, we all work in the industry, you know, we recommend each other. And for
Absolutely.
Me, like a lot of people have kind of, you know, everyone's busy, especially effects, like effects and lighting are two areas that, you know, you can never fall short on people. Everyone needs lighters, like rendering lighting and shading artists all the time. And everyone needs effects artists all the time. And I don't, you know, I can't say yes to everything. So I need to be able to recommend people. And like most of the people I know right now are all gigged up. So I want to be able to like literally construct my own team of people who are like, I've trained them up. I spent a year with these guys. I have taught them everything I know and I've made them follow through and do their work.
These are Alan McKay certified people, right?
Well, I guess so. Sure.
Yeah, no, but that makes a sense. I mean, because now, you know, like I can trust this guy. I know what he does. And then therefore, if someone asked me, can you recommend someone? I know without a doubt that this person knows the kind of stuff that I need to do. So
and there's been a lot of guys already who have gone to Framestore, to MPC, Pixelmondo, Scanline, and it's been so cool just to kind of see, like, you know, the basically the result of all these people.
There's a huge reward with when you find that one guy or one person. Mm-hmm. Like I remember that, you know, when I'm working on stuff and we were working on I think it was Oblivion at the time, and there was this one, we were looking for some junior guys to help out, and I got a bunch of demo reels, and this one guy came up and he's like, his reel was very different from everyone else. Mm-hmm. He's a super young guy. And he had a huge amount of ambition, but unbelievably humble at the same time, which was a key part because there's some guys out there who's like, yeah, I'm the badass. I want to do this and that. And they come in and like, yeah, by the way, you're going to have to work on some crappy shots for mm-hmm. like a year or two before you can cut your teeth. And they were just like really upset about it. But then there's this one guy and he's like, yeah, all right. I'm so glad. Thank you so much for doing this. And I said, you know what? And one thing you don't have experience is shot production. And I'm going to have you do a whole bunch of window lighting shots from the windshield, you know, just like mm-hmm. to get the windshield correct. And we're going to have you develop the process of what the windshield needs to look like. And it's going to be, that's going to be the stuff you're going to work on a while. And he's like, all right, let's do it. And he like showed it. And like every time I go to Dale, he's like, is this right? He's like, yep, you got it right. He's like, are you sure you got the reflection right? And he's like this. And then he just banged through it. And he was so good. And you know what? He's doing great right now. And he just knew it. He's like, I am learning shot production. I know how to render a shot, how to put it up there, how to do this, how to review it, how to make sure I get it approved. These are things that you don't learn at home. You like, you just do whatever you do, and there's no approval process. There's no submitting on a render farm, making sure you get your shot logged correctly. Like these are,
that's right.
Those are the things that you need to know. Like, you know, put it through dailies, run it through the comper, agree that you have all the elements that you need for your comper. You know, all of these aspects are things that you don't learn at home, you know?
Yeah. And I think like for me, like the biggest learning experience has always been, like you sit in dailies with like John Knoll and Dennis Muir and like they'll give you feedback and you're like, whoa, like, you know, I never thought of that. And like there's always big epiphanies you have just from sitting with people with all this experience. And for me, like that's kind of what I enjoy, is like we'll do all this material, but then I'll do live classes and I'll constantly review their work. Like I do it on the like our private forum and Facebook and all the stuff. But then like every 2 weeks, like we do like a big 3-hour session where I'll go through and I review everyone's work and I tell them how to improve their shots and I show them, okay, well, here's how you do it. And like we do these big live kind of powwows, and I do 2 a day because, you know, we're all scattered around the world, so not everyone's going to fit in that time zone. So I do one at 7 a.m. and one at 7 p.m. Sure. So that way it all fits. But for me, like it's, you know, I think that is valuable, and, you know, just to kind of have like someone be able to sit there and like show you and tell you like how to make your shots better, you know?
I there's an example that I love about, and this was, I wasn't on the show. This is, you know, hearsay, but it, like there was a supervisor of mine, and he was at Method at the time, and they were working on some big show, and they had a bunch of really talented junior guys that were working on stuff, and they were doing modeling. That was their job, modeling, right? And so they were supposed to model the whole environment or something like that was going on. And anyway, he came back the next day and they're like, well, none of your shots went through. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, why not? And goes, well, there was a 3,000 frame shot that went through the farm. And they're like, 3,000 frame shot? I was like, what's that? It's like, turns out it was a turntable that one of the modelers had put up of like a 3,000 frame turntable of the environment they had built. And they're very proud of the work they did. And they put it on the render farm. It just completely chewed up the entire render farm. They didn't think that way. It's like, oh, we got this giant render farm. It's like, oh, you don't realize that you just destroyed so many production shots that were supposed to be done. And that was something that was important for them to learn. It's like, oh, okay. That's the real world example that they need to know. It's like, yeah, you don't do 3,000 frame turntables.
In the beginning, like the more you learn process, like that's one thing actually this module I've kind of been hammering in into the training I'm doing is like rendering in tens. You know, it's like, okay, right now motion isn't as important as making sure that like we can go through the whole process of getting the comp and getting all the technical aspect of like GI, AO, everything all set up. So, you know, why render a 200 frame shot when all the frames are fairly heavy. So, you know, that's fine. Like render intense. And that way we get 20 frames instead of 200 and we can check it all out. If it looks good, we don't even need to go back into 3D. You go on the farm, you just change the increments to one frame and hit submit. But if there is something wrong, then you know, and you're not
and you haven't wasted, you know, 90% of your frames.
Exactly. Right?
So yeah, that's a very important lesson to learn. And those are lessons that, you know, I think that some of those guys can learn. Let me ask you this. You know, you've obviously said you've seen a lot of reels, especially from very junior guys. How many of those reels that you have seen have just been basically tutorial files that are resubmitted as demo reel stuff?
I've seen like a lot. I mean, I probably get about 20 something reels a week.
Sure.
I get a lot of people send me reels, but then, you know, I used to own a studio. I don't know if you know that or not, but like I had a studio for 5 years in Australia.
I didn't know that.
Did a lot of feature films like Daybreakers, other projects through there. And, you know, you go any studio, typically you're going to assemble teams anyway. And like, so you need to hand pick who you want on your team. And, you know, you look at a lot of work and you need to figure out what's good and what's not. Actually, one thing that's coming up I'm going to be doing pretty soon is I'm going to be doing reel reviews every month. Which is kind of cool because I did that with CG Society last year where we did this big event and everyone's in there.
That's cool.
Yeah. So
you like you'll get reels and you'll do reviews of them?
I'm going to do a public thing. And what I want to do is I want to bring on, and I'd love you to be a part of this. I'm going to be bringing on at least one different person every time we do it. So that way,
I'm totally there.
It's not just me. It's going to be like John Brennick, who's one of the lead compositors over at DD. You know, I'm going to bring him on. Todd Sheridan Perry, who's VFX Soup, we're going to bring him on. Actually, he came to me saying, Alan, you got to do this. I'm like, I'm already doing it. So, you know, that's something I want to do soon. So that way people send in all their reels. We critique him live and interact and actually we'll like unmute them on the webinar and like talk to them, you know, over that, you know, piece and say what you can improve, what to get rid of. It's really interesting doing that stuff. But for me, like, I've seen plenty of that. You see the tutorials, you see the training and it's kind of like, that's why if I do training, I always encourage people to make it their own shot. Because the other problem with doing tutorials is if you're just going off and following the settings, is that you're in a protected environment of, I did all the settings correctly. But then you do your own shot, you're going to be like, oh, well, you know, now it's different. Like I'm running all these issues.
Realize like.
So make it your own.
You can't, it's not a push, you know, it's not a push button scenario, right?
Yep.
It's like if you drive around the course with the driver's ed person, that's fine. But now get on the road and you're driving somewhere else. You got to realize that it's not the same thing. You know how to use the hand signal, but
that's right.
When do you use the hand signal and how to use this hand signal and when do you change gears or whatever else is going on?
Exactly. And I remember like I did a 3-day intense like boot camp back in 2003, I think it was. And I flew to Sydney and did this like big thing. And I remember having this big epiphany where one of the lessons was like how to build this like big volcano exploding shot. And I just remember seeing like 30 people all working from the same file. And I'm like, I can just picture 30 people with the same reel coming out. And it's just, and I get, you know, you can kind of project that idea in your head. And, you know, it's just, you know, ultimately you, you want to make your work unique and make it stand out. You can do training, that's fine, but take it a step further, make it your own. And that way it's not going to be like, oh, like the other problem too, is that if people don't realize where you're sourcing this from, if they just see a bunch of personal work and it's very identical, suddenly all these red flags come up. And even if later you let people know, like you want to have, you don't want there ever be anything on, you know, you be put on a radar for some reason, because like, for some reasons, like, I swear I've seen this shot before and someone else's personal reel. And
sure,
you know, so, you know, make it your own and make it different, push it extra step.
Right.
And that's why I love when I see my students, some of them will, let's say, do a wall being destroyed or whatever, but then they go on track, like they go and shoot a shot and then track it
in.
They
make their own thing.
Yeah. Then it's like, whoa, like you've gone even further.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your mentorship program, because this is something you're starting up, right? And it's not like a, you know, 6-hour thing or whatever. This is a long process, right? So how long does this course go for?
This to me has just completely changed my whole insight into training. And it is because I just wanted to have that kind of life-changing experience for everyone. And it's a year-long process. Like it's Right. It started as 8 months, but I'm making it this one longer, and it's a full-time job for me. Like I've turned down a lot of big projects this year already. Independence Day 2 is probably the biggest one. And
right.
Eddie Murphy, his producer called me about 2 weeks ago to talk about, like personally called me about his movie coming up. And there's a few things like that where I'm like, ah, that would be cool. But I'm committed now for a year to this thing. So
you're committed to training for the whole year.
I've literally, today I got up at 6 a.m. and I'm like, I'm meeting Chris at 6 p.m. So I've been like setting my alarm every hour to like kind of remind me to get work faster, because it's been just full on, because it's not like I'm doing like, oh, here's a tutorial. I'm like trying to do proper shots and go through the whole process and learn to comp, build tools, automate everything, build a pipeline. The whole thing has just been,
so creating the curriculum was actually kind of a big deal for you.
It's definitely been something where I did it, and then future Alan looks at it and I'm like, why did you do that to me? Because like it is at the point now. I'm like, wow, like this is so much work, and it's every module has been like, you know, several hours of training, and it's been really full on.
So. Well, let's talk a little bit about like the idea of what we were talking about over at dinner. How you start off. This is what I really liked about it. You're mainly training, this is an effects course, right? Because you come from the effects background, so you're dealing with, you know, explosions or destruction or something of that nature, or you're doing other types of effects stuff. And you'll train someone how to go through the process of like, all right, we're going to have a giant explosion, and here are all the steps you would need to do to make that happen. And, you know, all the debris you're going to do, all the smoke you're going to do, all the fire you're going to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and go through that whole process. And then they know that entire process. It's like, okay, so in order to do that, you know, it involves all of this work, which is a lot. And so I was like, okay, now I know that. And then what you're doing on top of that is, okay, so they've learned that, which they can, by the way, learn at a lot of places. But what you're doing, which I think is really cool, is like now you're teaching them how to take the entire process and script it out.
Yeah.
Because they're going to have to do it 100 times in production.
That's right.
And they don't want to do that process 100 times. So there's scripts and tools and things to automate that process. But it's like, oh, now that I've done it once, let me learn how to automate a lot of that so that throughout the entire feature film or whatever you're doing, that always looks the same.
That's right.
Because that's the reality of what happens in feature films. In terms of lighting or effects or whatever, a lot of the time, you know, 50% of the time is spent on one shot, and then the rest of the 50% of the shot is spent on the other 99 shots, you know?
That's right.
So that it always has that consistency. So you're training them like, here's how you do one. And once you've figured that out, now you know how to do the rest. And that actually is one of the most powerful things about production is, you know, taking what you've learned and figuring out how to make that as efficient as possible so that you pass it down the line, because you got to do it a lot more times.
Absolutely. And I think there's this huge misconception that like scripting is difficult and you got to know math and everything else to kind of be able to do it. Sorry, his chair's creaking a little.
That's okay.
But that's like the first thing I wanted to kind of disprove is just the fact that you like, I don't, you know, I left school when I was 13. I didn't learn algebra or anything. Like I did learn later on a lot of the stuff from just using Maya. But ultimately, you know, like everything that I approach as an artist. So for instance, like, you know, you might go and you, like, let's say I'm doing this shot right now. It's based on the work I did on Blade, doing all the vampires like burning up. And, you know, I don't just go and start coding. It's like you basically go and you construct the effect, you build it all, and then you go, okay, well, great, now I've built it all. Let me deconstruct like all the steps and like essentially wrap all that into a tool. And like I remember working on Blade 3, like we had 120 vampires we had to kill for that. And the process, like the pipeline for it, was essentially several artists who would build, like one would be building the smoke, one would be building the fire, one's building the sparks, and like there's this whole process. And at the time I was thinking like there's got to be a faster way to do it, and we did 120 vampires for this show, and like each one had revisions, those mistakes being made. What I ended up doing is like at the very end, once the project was done, I sat down and I decided, okay, and this is one of the first times I ever scripted, I'm like, I want to figure out a way to do this more efficiently. And I built a tool which I showed at Seagraph the next year where I literally pick a character, I hit a button, it generates like the kind of flaming map, which like the emission map. Mm-hmm. And I could look at that and say, okay, I like the timing, I'm happy, execute. And it would generate all the effects for me. And for me, that meant like I could see, like I'd have the shot done in a matter of minutes. And maybe you'll go back and revise it, you know, from there if you need to, but it was done. And you know, that wasn't hard. Like I did it without any previous experience doing scripting. Sure. And it meant that I could get a shot 99% of the way there right away. And since then, like bit by bit, like on Transformers and all these other shows, like it's become like the backbone of how I work. Like I had lunch with Rob Niederhorst yesterday, which we both know. And I was telling him about like, you know, I have not seen that many people working this way yet. Like for me, this is like how I work because I can juggle 3-4 productions at a time because for me, I automate as much as I can. I build tools around it. So that way when I actually am touching a shot, I'm touching it for the right reasons. I'll just give a quick example of like I worked on this short film called Flight and we had like so many shots to do. The budget was tiny. It was around 10 grand for VFX. It was nothing. And So I ended up saying, okay, great. I looked at two of the shots, got it approved with the director. And when we're all happy with it, I said, okay, great. Go track the shots, do everything, but follow these instructions, like name everything this way, do everything consistently. And then I literally got the shots back. I would hit a button. It would import and set up all the shots for me in the right directories, name it all, set up the render outputs, everything for me, and then simulate and render and put it in the Nuke. Right. And it sounds like a lot of work, but it's not. It's really straightforward. The thing was that before I even touch a shot, I would literally be seeing the first pass of it in Nuke, like comped and rendered.
Sure.
And it meant that, you know, sure, there's going to be issues like, okay, this clipped on this edge or this here is too sparse.
Yeah, but you got a first pass out.
Yeah, it means that I go back in and the first thing I'm doing when I'm touching a shot is like, okay, I got to add some more gravity to this shot. Okay, I got to make the box bigger in the shot. And it cut out so much of the setup time, so much of everything. And that to me has just been like a huge game changer.
To be honest, as someone who's going to hire someone as an example, and I'm looking at a reel, and if someone comes up to me and is like, here's a bunch of explosions and dust and whatever, and is like, okay, that's great, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if someone gave me a reel and said, you know, here's some stuff from Blade, whatever, and you showed a shot, and then you showed me a Camtasia session of you going through talking about how you made this tool to just do it, that would get my attention really fast.
The amount of money you can save on productions.
This guy can do effects, but this guy can actually like automate effects and really think about the efficiency of it. That is a huge aspect of the quality of the work. So absolutely, yeah.
I've seen that at a lot of studios I've gone to where like there'd be like the one guy who does the technical stuff and he's always like, you know, that's the one person who will not need to worry about like people being laid off. That person's the last to go. And it's always kind of like every studio I've worked at where there is like someone who is an artist, but they also do the technical aspect and they'll be able to build a tool or automate stuff. It just means that they're critical part of the company and they're the
efficiency experts. Right?
Yeah. Well, it's just, they have an ability that the other artists kind of don't do. And you know, I know some animators at Weta and other places who are animators, like the character animators, but they learned some scripting and they learned some other stuff. And it meant that suddenly they're able to do so much more and think a bit differently to how they might otherwise be. And like, it just, you know, kind of breaking through that barrier. And like, I think most people, the only thing holding them back is the fact that they don't know where to start and they do find it too intimidating. And typically the training is like, anytime I sit down and look at scripting, I'm like, holy crap, like what is like a Boolean 0.3 and all these other like, you know, like all the stuff gets thrown at you. You don't know how to read it, but if you, in the training I've been putting out, like even free stuff on this subject, like, you know, one of the simplest things is like, okay, let's automate our render output. So you save a new max file, it automatically builds your render output directory for you. Suddenly, you're not having to worry about versioning up or simple things, but all these things after a while start to like save you so much time. And as soon as you realize how easy it is, it's like, whoa, okay, like what else is there I can do, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's been your a lot of your focus has been obviously on trying to get people up to date and feeling that you can do that. And I think it sounds like you were slightly motivated by the idea that people kept approaching you about finding new talents. Like, well, let me make new talent, right?
So, to a degree. At least it means that there are people that I've trained and I know that, you know, it's not going to be everyone, but like the ones who really, even if like they aren't the best, but they've applied themselves and they've listened to everything I say, then great. Like they're the kind of people I'm going to say, okay, well, look, you know, even this guy or girl isn't, you know, really, really amazing yet, but he or she is able to follow direction. And like, I vouch for these people. And
right.
The rest of them is just more about continuing through the course for a bit longer. And for me, it's more of like a lifelong like thing. Once you sign up, you'll have access to
sure.
everything for forever. And our thing keeps growing. Like I've only had it open once. Like I launched it the week of Christmas. It was like the worst week to launch. Like I thought, but, yeah, like I only opened it for 1 week and I closed it down before the week was over because too many people came in. And I'm about to open it again. You know, I didn't expect us to actually talk about this, but
sure. But
I'm actually opening it up again in about a week, just for that 1 week. And so it's going to be a chance just, you know, to let more people in. And everyone who's currently in the mentorship is like really excited about that as well. Like that was kind of cool. Is just the fact that they're like, oh, you got more students coming in. So everyone's like, cool. Like, yeah, I can't wait to get them in and we can show them what we've been learning. So,
right.
And we got like a private Facebook group as well as the forums and as well as the live classes.
Great.
So it's kind of like a 24/7 thing. I was in Paris recently and a lot of guys from Europe all flew over and
sure.
like, we ended up getting drunk the whole time. So it was kind of fun.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I want to talk a little bit about something else because it's a little bit related, but, listening to your podcast, which we're going to get to the podcast part of mm-hmm. it as well, but you talked to Dan Rorty, who I know very well, and apparently you know very well from the podcast I listen to. Well, actually, I don't know him very well, but he is a member of the Digital Human League, and you guys were talking about some stuff that was very interesting to me in terms of the fact that you're Australian, he's Canadian, et cetera, and you're mm-hmm. You obviously have to work in a global industry right now, right? So you always have to travel and you always have to deal with visa situations. And the United States was a big hub for visual effects for a long time. And it was a little bit of a challenge in order to get in here. And so part of the motivation for people like you and him was to promote yourself. And that was the only way that you could validate your existence in order to get visa situations, right? Mm-hmm. So your self-promotion, what was interesting to me about it, it's like, okay, well, that kind of sucks that you have to constantly validate yourself mm-hmm. in order to be able to continue to have the job that you want to get. But at the same time, what happens is interesting to me is that you constantly have to look back on yourself, right? So if you constantly have to say, oh, I got to get a demo reel, I got to do this, I got to do that mm-hmm. in order to validate who I am, you are constantly putting yourself in check to see yep. what have I done. And so therefore there's an almost an obligatory motivation to make your work better, right?
Absolutely.
So that's actually kind of an advantage in a way to do that. But the idea of like, yeah, what does it take to promote yourself, to do this, to do that? I mean, so how has that helped you in the long run?
I'm probably the worst person to actually say how it's helped me because I think anyone else would be able to kind of answer that better. But I do think that it's a 24-hour thing. And like, I honestly think that your career, you got to treat it like a business. You got to treat yourself like a studio.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go into that. Explain that exactly.
So most people, like, this is going to sound condescending, but I honestly do think a lot of people do kind of think of themselves as cattle, you know, like they want to just be told what to do, where to go, where to show up. And that's why like DAA, a digital artist agency, is actually
right.
good in that regard. Cause like, if that's what you want, then you can just say, all right, well just tell me who, you know, you go find me to work and I'll be there. Mm-hmm. But most people, like they don't really want to have to worry about like actively chasing all this stuff, looking for work, you know, talking to studios and being really active. But the thing is that, you know, I always say you could be the best artist in the world, and if no one knows who you are, then what does it matter? And
right,
you know, like I do honestly think you need to treat yourself like a studio or a company in the regard that, you know, 15% of you needs to be the marketing person, you know, 10% needs to be the accountant.
Yep.
You know, you need to be a manager as well as the artist. And that's where, you know, when there's an imbalance, like the artist might want to go and do crazy stuff and the manager needs to say, well, look, you know, you've got to get all this stuff done by the end of the week. So you're wasting too much time here. Take a step back, you know, focus on the other things. And the more you start to manage all these things, the more you become so self-efficient, proficient in what you're doing. And people around you notice it as well. Like I noticed that about me when I started being more communicative. I always get communicative about everything that I do, like starting to talk to everyone and fill in producers about where I'm at instead of hiding from producers early in my career. Like, oh, if you know, if they don't see me, they can't harass me.
Sure.
If I start telling them like, hey, these are all on the farm. This is actually behind. I'm not going to get it done today. I'm really sorry. They're going to be like, great. That's awesome. Thank you so much.
At least
like,
thank you for the feedback.
Yeah. Instead of being like, you know, me expecting like, oh crap, I'm going to get yelled at. And the more you start to kind of manage all these things and be careful about it, like the better you do. And I freelance so much and I see people say like, oh, you know, I today's my last day, so I better start like cutting a reel next week. And it's like, dude, like you should have been doing that weeks ago. Like, why are you waiting till the end of the job to then cut a reel? So like 2 weeks from now, you're going to start looking for a work a month from now, maybe, you know, and people are always afraid that like they should be, you know, like if you go get a LinkedIn account or go talk to a studio, your company might think you're looking for work. It's like, no, like you should be 24/7 talking to everyone and seeing what's going on. And that way, 3 weeks from now, before a job even finishes, you already know what's going on at every studio.
The best time to look for a job is when you already have one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Always don't look for a job when you don't have one, because that's when you're the most desperate. Just always make sure that you have the best contacts all the time. Because, I mean, I had a friend of mine, and he was like, it was the exact situation where it was a freak weird thing where he was because he was working for a large studio. I'm not going to mention who they were, but he was looking for a large studio. And they said, oh, crap, well, the shot's not actually going to happen. So we're going to lay off like 25 people for some random reason. And he was just like a name picked out of a hat.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. You got laid off. It's like, what? And then he's like, all right. And they just literally picked his name out of a hat. And I'm not kidding you when I said that. And so he's like, okay, but he had enough contacts that he's like, all right. So he went outside, got on his cell phone, and he got a job within 2 hours with a contract handed over to him, right?
That's great.
Because that was fine. And then the studio that laid him off realized, oh shit, we can't fire this guy. We need him to finish all the other stuff. He's actually a really important person, because they literally picked a name out of a hat. And he said, well, I'm sorry. I just got another job.
Yeah. And P.S. screw you. You know?
P.S. screw you. Like, I got a job in 2 hours and they offered me a raise. So unless you can match that and a contract, I can't do it.
An apology.
I know. It's like, and so, those things don't happen anymore. but you have to, it's like, oh, I have these contacts. I have this LinkedIn. Like, literally, it's really, really important to know, have your ear on the ground.
Yeah.
So the reason I brought that up is because you and I both have a podcast. We started around the same time, by the way, which has been really cool. My podcast is very different than your podcast, but yet still for the same crowd, which is really cool. But what I like about your podcast is literally teaching people, like, this is the information you need to know about that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So yours is about that specific material, which is really cool. So what motivated you to do that kind of podcast?
For me, like for instance, you know, you're doing such a, like, I love the podcast you're doing because you have access to so much talent and it's always really interesting stuff that these guys and girls are doing. And at the same time, like, you know, you can go and nerd out about a lot of stuff, but you can also do a lot of really original content. Then there's a few other ones like that are more specifically about 3D. And like, for me, like, I've got a mixed bag of followers, from designers and people who aren't even in the industry through to more like Weta, Pixar, whatever other studios that listen. And it's so cool to kind of get that big audience. And for me, it was never about like, I didn't care as much about the technical aspect as I did about more, I think that the one area people don't pay attention to is their career, and it's such a big thing. And so I wanted to kind of really focus on more of the core stuff that kind of gets neglected and that people really need to learn. And I've been doing a lot of kind of, obviously mentoring, but also just helping people with their careers for years now.
Well, I thought it was really interesting, just going back to the Dan Rorty one, because you brought it up as an example. We talked about it, you know, how Dan Rorty was apologizing for talking about visas, right?
Right.
But for the context of your podcast, that's like critical, right?
Yeah.
It's so important because that's how people are like, oh, okay, if I live in Iceland and I want to go work in the United States, mm-hmm. these are the steps I have to do that. And then, okay, so now if I'm going to do here, I'm going to do there, and this is where the jobs are. So those are critical information that I think they're very important. And that's really great career advice in general.
Most people don't like really understand like how this stuff works. So it's kind of like this big black hole.
Yeah. And you even mentioned in the podcast how you actually want to bring an immigration lawyer mm-hmm. into your podcast so they have that understanding.
I did. I touched on, I've done like so many from, you know, how to freelance to how to quit your job and work from home to one thing I'm doing later. I've kind of touched base on a little bit, but like how to build a studio, how to do branding, like there, you know, how to ask for a raise. I've actually, one of the biggest things I've done was I wrote like one of the, I put out a lot of email templates of like actual emails that I use. Like I'll send out something along those lines to studios when I'm looking for work, and I'll deconstruct everything on it. So there's like a private, like a, you know, VIP list as part of the podcast. Like sure. If you sign up for that, you get like, you know, all this stuff, and it's all free. It's just more like other content, but that there like has gotten 50, 60 people that I know of jobs because they've been applying for forever, and then they rewrote their letter to follow that template, and suddenly they get callbacks, they get replies, they get jobs. And there's been a lot of that where it's just more about rethinking how you do stuff. And with the, like initially I touched base on visas on one of my solo episodes, and I got a huge amount of feedback, like thousands of, well, yeah, there was so many thousands of people listening to that one episode. And then the amount of people who reached out to me about it was just phenomenal. And it made me think, okay, well, this is something I do want to touch base on more. Dan started talking about it. I'm like, let's go for it.
They want to hear it from a different perspective.
And
absolutely.
One of the biggest immigration firms who does like everyone in film, as well as like all the big talent, around like the US, like, I'm hopefully going to be getting them on soon to talk about
that's
process.
Really great. You
know? Yesterday I did one with RSP that I mentioned, mm-hmm. and like that was really great because I actually drilled them extensively because as a studio, getting their perspective of like, well, you know, for us to hire someone, we need to make sure they qualify before we offer them a job. I qualify for all these things and, you know, figure out whether or not we can get them a visa, and here's the process. Like we talked really extensively. It'll come out in like a week or two, but we talked extensively about like the whole hiring process from like sending your application in and then like who looks at it, what happens, like how many times does it get like reviewed before like they make the decision about who's getting hired and who makes the decision. But sure. Then like what's the process from getting hired and what you can do to, you know, to maximize your opportunity, like even mentioning some of the stuff that you have or have done so that way they know if, like they're more comfortable, like, okay, we definitely can get that person a visa, so let's green light this and move forward with it, you know?
So yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. I mean, have you enjoyed doing podcasting?
That's what I loved, like the fact that we could talk about that like last time. Cause I mean, yeah, it's for me, I was telling you about this at dinner. Like I didn't know anything about podcasting when I had done it. I've done some things similar to it in the past where it was like video and like shooting like interview series stuff. And like, that was so painful, but you take video out, it's a lot easier. And it's one of the guys at Blur, he's at ILM now, but he was telling me, he's just like, Alan, like you need to do a podcast. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. And over a few days, it started to grow on me because I listen to podcasts all the time. And like most of the information I get, like education is from
oh, it's great.
Podcasts. And so after a while, I'm like, this actually makes a lot of sense. And then, you know.
I was thinking about it myself because when I was starting to do this podcast, it was just kind of a whim, a little bit. I was like you know.
Right.
I loved podcasts, right? And I listened to a lot of it. And I've mentioned it on a previous podcast that a lot of the style of this podcast is heavily influenced by what one of my favorites, which is the Nerdist podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I started to realize like, okay, how do they do their stuff, you know? So part of me is like, you know, I don't try to edit it too much, right? I try to keep it really raw. And that actually helps because that means I don't have to fucking edit it, right?
Natural too.
Yeah, you know? It's natural and it's like, yeah, whatever. If we're going to have a weird conversation, it's going to be a weird conversation.
Right.
And that feels like whoever's listening is in the room with us And they're just part of that conversation because, like, a lot of the people who are listening to this don't necessarily have the privilege of hanging out with you and I in a room, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a great idea.
It's Friday because we'll both be drinking it.
That's right. And so those are always fun conversations. And then the other thing is, like, you know, it's actually not that expensive to do. Mm-hmm. You need to get some little audio equipment here and there, and you got to figure out how to do it. And producing it is you know, some work. Especially like you and I now, I'm trying to do one a week, which is, you know, it's a little more work.
Yeah.
It takes a little time. And I'm producing it myself, which I really could use a producer.
I am, but I want to find someone soon to help out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. And I've done most of them just live because that's been easier. And you've been doing a lot of them on Skype. So I'm actually going to hit you up on some of your Skype tools because I've been doing Skype through my laptop to the mixing board and it works, but I gotta figure out a better way to do it. So, I'm definitely gonna hit you up some tricks because it's gonna work out. But I love the fact that I can sit down because oh my god, what a great opportunity to hang out with whoever it is. And what's really cool is that I know that yours has been fairly successful and mine has been getting fairly successful. Now I'm suddenly getting calls from people. It's like, hey, I want to be on your podcast. Mm-hmm. I got this idea.
Yeah.
And they're like, great, you know? Mm-hmm. So it becomes a really good way to have a conversation with people. And it's been really, really, really fun to do that. So I love the fact that it's like, you know, the first thing when you said, hey, Chris, I want to do a podcast with you, is like, awesome, because I'm going to do the same to you.
You mentioned it at the time, and I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I've done a few podcast interviews since then, and it's kind of weird because, you know, we both get like, you know, do like interview stuff all the time, but after doing so many podcasts where I'm the one interviewing and then kind of get it reversed, it was like the first time I did that for Pencil King's podcast, I was like, whoa. Like, it's kind of weird being, like, tables are turned and I'm the one.
Yeah, who... I know, because I, like, realized, like, when I did your podcast, like, oh, my God, I was talking the whole time.
I did one with Tobin Kirk, and he's an exec producer over at Blind, and he's such a producer. He sat down, he started driving the whole thing. He's like, okay, what are we talking about? What's the content here? You know, let's do this and this. I'm like, dude, I'm doing this. You're going to sit down and just relax, have a drink. Right. But yeah, it's kind of funny, like, just to see everyone's different approach. I will say the podcast, like, for me, it's been a bit of a guilty pleasure because bit by bit, it's meant that I've suddenly gotten to talk to people about, you know, that I want to talk to about stuff that I think would be really beneficial to me. And, you know, there's guys, you know, that I've got, like, I've got some really awesome ones coming up. And, like, even some, like, authors of books that I've found just be really influential to my career that I've reached out to, and they're, like, totally on board for doing that.
That's awesome.
And just, you know, guys like Andrew Kramer from Video Copilot, other people like that. It's just been cool to shoot the shit. Like, we've talked back and forth.
Absolutely.
And never, you know,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's just kind of been
the other one I really liked that you did. And he was so affable. He was such a nice guy. And the VR guy, right?
Yeah. That's hilarious that you said that. Because he actually just texted me like 2 days ago. He's like, hey, I'm going to be in LA Sunday till Thursday.
I would love to meet that guy.
Yeah, I told him like to come to the industry drinks thing. He's flying back to London, but I'm going out Monday night if you want to come along.
Maybe, yeah.
Like, it's so funny, but like I nearly texted him saying like I've got a bit of a man crush because as soon as you said you're coming to LA this week, I'm like, yippee. So the fact that you said that, who's that nice guy? I'm like, that's Sol.
Yeah, he was so nice. And
he's awesome.
What's his last name?
Rogers.
Sol Rogers, right. And the way that he talked about VR, it, like, everything he said was so dead on and accurate and everything exactly I felt. And he said it in the right way where it's like, yep, it makes sense. And at the same time, it's like, I completely trusted what he was saying. Mm-hmm. Really good. And you're right. Good man crush on that one. Cause I agree. He was a really good guy. And that's a nice thing, right? Because you get to have these things, these conversations with these people you don't expect. Right.
Yep.
One of my favorite, podcasts I did on mine, I've done a lot of great ones, there was one that I did with Jay and Graham from ICT, and it was going to be fun. I know it was going to be fun, but Graham went on this hilarious rant about some extremely technical stuff that was so funny, and we were cracking up. He was talking about what is the actual ISO value of your eyeball and how it was going to – and it was – really funny and it was, and it's legitimate. He's actually not really joking, but it sounded like a big joke.
Right.
And it was like, you get these unexpected conversations that happen all the time, you know?
Well, not to toot your horn, but like when we did the episode for my podcast, like that was just a blast because like, A, we both got a lot of history, but it was just so insightful, like talking about all the side projects that you as well as Chaos Group Labs is doing. It's just like, you know, the Digital Human League, amongst other things. Like I was learning so much, you know, it was just really insightful getting to like hear a lot of the stuff, even to do with like hardware rendering and all the you know,
all the construct stuff. Yeah.
And like, you know, I know Kevin, like, you know, Kevin Margan, I've worked with him plenty of times and, you know, I had a chance to work in Construct and unfortunately I got buried in my email. I told you about that. Thing is that like the stuff you were telling me is like, I had no idea about it. It's just like, wow, like that's so cool. And it's also one of those, touching on that whole thing, like it's such an innovative thing that like, it's kind of rare these days that you hear about something that's just so mind blowing. It's like, wow, you're connecting like V-Ray in real time into all these other packages and doing like literally doing real time rendering on a mocap set. Like, it's just like, whoa, like this is one of those things that you can see becoming in the future, you know, like,
And I think also what happens is that even if you know someone really well, or you think you've known someone really well, right? Like as an example, I've worked under Scott Ross and I've heard Scott Ross talk a bunch of times and he always like, every time I speak to Scott Ross, it's like a 5 to 10 minute conversation. That's all I get, right? Because that's all you have. So it's either a little clip from here, or a little interview here, or a little him on the podium for a thing. And I hadn't sitting down here for an hour and 10 minutes telling me everything where he actually told me everything, but now I can really get in depth. Mm-hmm. And I heard all the same stories, but a lot more in depth. And it was really brilliant because like, oh, great, you know, and I was thinking about it in a sense and I was like, oh, wow, you know, I really get to know someone a lot better. I'm going to go back to, we're running long, but we're cool. I'm going to go back to this a little second because one of my neighbors who a friend of mine, actually, his son is a friend of my son and they're both 5 years old. Let me just put that in perspective, but it's Wayne Knight, right? Mm-hmm. And Wayne is the guy who plays Newman on Seinfeld, in case you guys need any perspective on that. Right. He's also the computer nerd on Jurassic Park.
I was going to say, like, forget Seinfeld, Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park. He's the computer nerd on yeah, exactly. He's that guy. So he's a really interesting, fun guy and he's a really hilarious guy. And he was on the Nerdist podcast, right? And so our kids were hanging out at the park and I was talking to him. He's like, hey, by the way, I heard you on Nerdist. And he goes, oh, yeah. And he goes, and I said, you talked about a lot. And he goes, yeah, you know, I'm used to like the 2 to 5 minute interviews and I have here an hour or so. And I talked about my entire life.
That's awesome.
And talked about all these things. I was like, yep, people really got to know you. And goes, I knew, as an example, like Wayne has a private investigator license, right? He still has it today. Wow. He still has his private investigation license. And he talks about what it was like to be a private investigator. That's a long story that you can't tell in a 2 minute clip, right? Or you can say like, I used to be a private investigator, end of story, because I got to move on to pitch whatever else I'm doing. But he actually got to explain what it was like to do that. And I was like, yeah. Hour-long interviews and stuff, you get to really know someone. You get to really get into some meat that's important. I think that's the power of podcasts. It's like, oh, you want to know something? All right, get it on. And it's like, you know, when I was first did this podcast and I was telling people, it's like, yeah, I got the podcast out there. And it's like, great. And they'd like, this is an hour long. It's like, yeah, it's an hour long and it's going to continue to be, you know, because that's how you're going to really get to know something that's going
on. And I found I did Artist Insight series was something I tried years ago, and it's always meant to be just kind of like this fun shooting the shit thing. And I only put out 5 episodes. I had 25 I'd done, and they're awesome, and I will put them out sometime. But like the video became a bit of an issue. But just listening to them while I was working, like I would just put them on as like a 2 hour interview, and I'd be working and listening. Even though I was in the room recording it, I would still be fascinated while I'm working listening to this interview that I did, just because of like how insightful it is to talk to someone who worked, you know, on Star Wars or, you know, directs films for a living. And I love how they are a bit more free for all, like Nerdist. And that's what I loved, is like they'll go in directions you never imagined.
Right.
And for me, like, you know, who cares about the length if like it's something you can put on the background and you learn so much while you're doing other stuff. It's not like you're sitting there 100% focused on it. But it's just so informative. And The other thing for me was just like working at ILM and all these other big studios, we'd be having lunch and someone would mention again, like something like Star Wars, like, oh yeah, on, you know, Jurassic Park or whatever, like, you know, we had to do this because of that.
Right.
And, you know, I would think, wow, like, you know, if, you know, I would pay to be sitting in this conversation. And same thing on panels that we get, you know, brought to a Seagrass, stuff like that. People literally do pay right. to sit with like Zap Anderson, me, Neil Blevins, all these other guys yep. on stage. And literally it's like a few hundred people sitting in a room while six of us nerd out about motion blur samples or whatever. And they're frantically writing it all down.
Yep.
But that's just it. Like, it's such informative stuff. You get a few people together who just, you know, have been doing it forever and can just spit out so much great information. And
well, for me, it really is about my drive, right? Mm-hmm. So I have a longer drive. I have about a 45 to an hour drive every morning, and it's probably about a half an hour.
Where do you live?
I live over in Burbank area, so it's a little bit of a drive. But that was a thing, right? So before podcasts were really popular, what did people do on those drives? They listened to morning radio, right?
Yep.
And you had crappy morning DJs doing crappy interviews, and they try to get your attention by being really idiotic, right? Mm-hmm. And it worked for a long time. And then when podcasts started to come out, it's like, oh, I don't have to listen to that shit. I can listen to something that is incredibly relevant to what I care about,
yeah.
right?
Or Tim whatever. Tim Ferriss interviews Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right. And so I don't listen to the radio at all anymore. So Same. There's two things that I used to listen to when I was driving. One was podcasts and the other one was audiobooks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because audiobooks to me became a revelation. It's like, oh crap, you know, I'm very dyslexic. So this is a huge part of who I am. So even though I can write, et cetera, reading is actually really hard for me to be able to keep that attention span in the terms of the act of physically reading. So audiobooks actually turns out to be like a huge revelation to me. Like, I can have access to this. So I remembered, I forgot which movie I was working on. I think I was working on Tron, and I was totally engaged in the Millennium series. So Girl with a Dragon Tattoo and mm-hmm. all that stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, it's I remember actually I would leave work at the worst possible time at DD so that I'd be in traffic for a long time so I could listen to longer periods of the book, and I was like really engaged in it. And then when Eric Barber told me, it's like, oh yeah, we're going to work on Girl with a Dragon Tattoo with Eric Fincher David Fincher, I was like, oh yeah, I'm totally involved. So
I'm just going to jump in and say that's another one of those screw ups. Tobin Kirk, who I interviewed, like I'd helped him out a bit, like just, you know, throwing jobs his way and stuff, and he ended up producing all the big title sequence for Girl Dragon Tattoo at Blur. And he called me up and he's like, hey man, like, I just started here. We're doing this thing. Come over. And I'm like, dude, literally this morning I agreed because they took me out and got me drunk to do this toy car commercial.
All right.
Out of everything. So I'm like, I just agreed to do it. So I can't do Girl the Dragon Tattoo. And I was like, I really want to do this. So it's another one of those, like, I could tell you 100 stories of how I turned down Lord of the Rings.
Exactly.
Everything else.
Yeah. So anyway, those types of things have became very important. I think now it is the point where, like, now you have access to the most specific type of podcasts that are available. And the fact that, like, I'm doing a podcast that's, like, very, very, very specific, and we're still getting the audiences we're getting, both you and I, and, like, that's great. I feel like it's validating what we're doing, and I think it's great. And it sort of inspires us to do more stuff. So I think it's really cool. So I love doing them, and I'm glad you're doing them. And I definitely need to follow up on more stuff you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Let me know what else is going on in your training side of things, because I think training is a huge part of it. And I know you're trying to get involved in doing some more training stuff on some of our own software. Mm, so when that happens, let me know, and I'll make sure to plug it on what we're doing as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. All right. Yeah, this is running a little bit long, so I'm gonna let the last bucket drop on this one. And thanks so much, Alan. I appreciate it.
No, man. Thank you.
Absolutely. Really cool. All right. Thanks, guys.